3-21-0058 Edgar County Watchdogs Appellee versus Will County Sheriff's Office Appellant.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning, Justices. Assistant State's Attorney Kevin Myers on behalf of Appellant Will County Sheriff's Office.
And good morning.
Good morning.
Go ahead. Sorry.
No, I'm sorry, Matt. Go ahead.
Matt Topic for the appellee.
Okay. Thank you both. Mr. Myers, would you like to start?
Yes. Thank you, Justin McDade. This is a FOIA appeal, Freedom Information Act appeal from the Circuit County in Will County. I'm sorry. For summary judgment in favor of the appellee on counts 1 and 4 of their underlying complaint. It's not a factually difficult case, and I will get into some of the facts, but I think the two important things from the appellant's point of view is there are two real central themes to this case. One is that FOIA is a governmental transparency law. I think that's very, very clear. The cases lay that out, and the legislative intent makes that clear. What it is not is a pathway for citizens to gain information on other citizens. There is no governmental benefit or civic benefit in using government resources to gain information on other citizens. Secondly, FOIA is not intended to create an obligation, or does not create an obligation on the part of a local public body to create records which it does not already have in its possession. It's clear from the legislative intent that this is not a records creation law, it's a records production law. So the underlying facts in this case is that appellee asked, sent Free Information Act requests to the Will County Sheriff's Office. We can see the Will County Sheriff's Office is a public body. The request sought various information about 911 calls and police reports in Wesley Township and a park within Wesley Township, Wesley Rivals Park. The Sheriff's Office partially denied and partially granted the request. What was given to the appellee was the what's called a CAD report, a computer aided dispatch, which is a computer printout of a dispatch sheet to the police, as well as portions of the incident report from the responding deputies to the extent they were created. I think the first issue to the easiest issue to dismiss and to deal with is the creation of a records issue. As I said, it's clear from the legislative intent that FOIA does not require a public body to create records which it does not ordinarily maintain. To follow the circuit court's order, it's inescapable that a new record must be created.
Which new record is that?
That would be either the creation of a transcript or the masking and remixing of the original audio so as to remove the tonal qualities of the original recording. What we might be familiar with is, you know, the audio you hear on the 9 o'clock news that's muffled and to protect an individual's identity.
So you're not being asked to create any new content. You're just being asked to create, to produce the record in a usable form.
I would argue we are being asked to create content in that changing the original record in such a way that it no longer identifies an individual, as is the circuit court indicated that tonal qualities of a voice may be identifying, that resulting secondary record, the muffled or the transcribed record, would be a secondary form of content.
So if you redact a document that you have, that's a different document?
I think that's readily distinguishable, Justice. I believe when you are redacting a document, what you're doing is simply removing information from that document. If I take a black marker and strike out a portion, or if I were to cover up someone's face in a picture, I'm simply removing information. I'm not adding new information to that.
So how does one redact a tape?
I don't believe, well, you could redact a tape by striking portions of the tape. For example, if...
And how do you do that?
That could be done through a software that I don't believe the sheriff at the time had, but that would be done through perhaps muting of the audio for a portion, say a social security number was mentioned. You would simply mute the audio or add some sort of a tone to that that would remove a portion of remove a portion of the recording is how I would describe it.
Okay, and how does that differ from redact?
What I think is being asked here is a removal plus. A removal plus adding extra information. We're not being asked to simply remove the audio because per our arguments and per the court's ruling on the tonal qualities, we would just have to redact the entire thing because when the person is being asked to speak, their voice is coming through. What we're being asked to do is to give the person essentially a new voice. It has to change the voice so much that you as a listener couldn't determine who that speaker is. So I think it's a secondary step rather than just striking out a portion of data. It's actually adding new data.
Okay, so when we look at the statute and we look at the purpose and the legislative intent, the public policy and the legislative intent, what we see is a paragraph that talks about new technology. And it says that there will be the development of technology that was not within their knowledge at the time the statute was adopted. And what they tell us is that we're supposed to interpret or deal with that new technology in the spirit of the law that's already set out, which is you're supposed to produce whatever you can produce reasonably. So you're dealing with a tape. Don't you think that requires you to do whatever is reasonably available to you to do to make it producible without changing the content?
Well, I think when you're talking about new technology, you're talking about how records are stored, I think, more than what's being asked here is to transform the document. I don't think that's a technology issue. I think it is more of an issue of this is adding data rather than just dealing with a new technology.
Well, you said that there's a program that's available that allows you to scramble and mask. You said the sheriff's department didn't have it at the time, but that it did exist. Is that correct?
That was the argument made by Appalee, and I take that at its face value. I'm not familiar with I'm not an audio engineer, so I'm not sure what the capability of those things are, but I do take that at face value. They do exist. What I'm arguing is not that there is new technology that makes this feasible. What I'm saying is that even if, regardless of how it's stored, this is a not a technology situation. Technology doesn't make it available.
Okay, I'm not talking about how it's stored. I'm talking about the format in which it's been produced and what is available to you to basically correct what you say is what makes it not producible by the sheriff's office.
I would argue that in transforming it in such a way, it's not simply making it available due to new technology. It is so transformative, and it must be so transformative to protect the identity of the speaker that it constitutes a new record.
Okay. I don't want to dominate your argument, so why don't you go ahead?
I won't belabor that point any further. As I've said, I believe the tonal qualities, if you change the tonal qualities to such a degree that they are no longer recognizable to a listener. They are therefore it's creation of new record. It's not simply a formatting issue. The court also gave the option of creating a transcript. I think that is also clear. It's not a format issue. We're not asking you to produce a document in, for example, a PDF format versus a Word format. That I think might be an appropriate format issue. What's being asked here is for a human listener to listen to a series of audio inputs, to interpret those audio inputs, and then reduce to paper what they believe to be said on an audio tape. That will never be original. It's not a transformation of file formats or a transformation of a document to a readable form. It is always going to be a interpretation of that original document. So in that sense, I believe that the appellate or the circuit court was in error, because in either scenario, a new record is created. Secondarily, I think the issue is that even if a new record was not created, and when we don't concede that case, the redaction or the scrambling of the audio or the transcription of the audio is not sufficient to create protect the privacy under exemption DIV that protects the identity of those who provide information to law enforcement. As we lay out in our appellate documents, there are many things that encompass one's identity. Certainly physical description, as the court noted, the tonal qualities of a voice, certainly even information that one might have could identify that speaker. Black's Law Dictionary is clear that that identity goes beyond one's name or their address. It's the distinguishing personality or attributes of an individual, more generally their qualities and attitudes that a person or a group of people have that differentiates them from others. So here we're brought to a situation where the content of a statement is also going to be something that can be used to identify an individual. Ms. Wall, the responding FOIA officer, went through point by point based on her experience and her extensive experience in FOIA, laying out how the content of one statement may explain who that person is, or importantly, who that person isn't. We're dealing with a very small township here and a singular park for a small amount of time. It becomes very easy when you know exactly what that person is saying to the police to determine who may be speaking to the police. We also point out that goes to the heart of whether there needs to be a creation or whether there's a transcription issue is we've provided, or the sheriff, I'm sorry, has provided their computer-aided dispatch logs, which show how far or how they responded to the calls, and they provided their portions of the reports. What a citizen is providing to another governmental agency is not the purpose of FOIA. It's not to keep an eye on individuals. It's an eye to open governmental records. So if the only thing we're here to do is see what those individuals are communicating to the government, there's not a compelling FOIA interest there. And in that sense, we don't believe that allowing the content of the statements by individuals presents a compelling reason to overcome the statutory exemption under DIV. And with that, I will ask for any questions.
Does the statute require compelling?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Does the statute require a compelling interest?
It does not use the word compelling, but there needs to be some sort of interest. And that was a mistake on my part, misspeaking on my part. But there must be some sort of interest in the content of the individual's statement for it to even be a FOIA issue, because the whole basis of FOIA is that it's to open up governmental records and to give people a way to meaningfully participate with their government. It's unclear to me, and it has not been briefed, as to how private individual statements help individuals be aware of their government's action.
It's a government action to receive a 911 report, is it not?
Your Honor, that is true, and that's what I said. The dispatch records show the governmental response. There is an exemption there for the identity of those who provide information to law enforcement, indicates that there isn't so much of an interest in receiving that information. I can't explain to you what governmental function there is in respond or in transcribing an individual statement. I guess I would respond to that.
Okay. Are there any other questions for Mr. Myers?
I've got a question. I know Mr. Myers, implicit in some of your written material is the expense that the governmental body would incur and the bureaucratic tie-up that the sheriff's office would be involved with if the court order were to be followed. My question is, would your position on those points be any different if the trial court here had ordered that the expense of providing the software to scramble the voice transcripts and or the expense of providing somebody to do the transcription were placed on Edgar County, would your position change?
So to a certain extent, I think the explicit answer or the situation with Edgar County in its own case, that may be a workable situation, but Edgar County watchdogs are not the only individuals that would be interested in this sort of information. I think at a certain point, it becomes an administrative burden on the large scale, where it becomes a staffing issue as well. Now, certainly that wasn't before the circuit court, so I don't have those numbers for you, but simply just the staffing and administrative time to do that, it should even insignificant portion of the county were to want transcripts or scrambling of audio on a regular basis. And I hope that answers your question.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions?
No.
No.
Thank you, Mr. Myers.
Thank you.
Mr. Topic?
Good morning, and may it please the court, Matt Topic for the appellee. Before I get into the merits arguments, as I was preparing over the weekend, it occurred to me for the first time that there's a jurisdictional issue that I think ought to be squared away. So the appeal was brought under Rule 301, but the order below did not resolve the claim for attorney's fees and left that open for further proceedings. So there is not a final order as to all claims. Our fault, we should have caught that in the response brief, and I only noticed it for the first time as I was preparing, but with it being a jurisdictional issue, I thought it'd be appropriate to raise it. There was no 304A finding, but I think the appeal can proceed under Rule 307A because the order to produce the records is in the nature of an injunction. And so while it wasn't styled that way, we would have no objection whatsoever in proceeding under 307. But I just wanted to raise that with it being a jurisdictional issue. I know that's always something that appellate courts are concerned about ensuring they have jurisdiction. So I did want to raise that. Turning to the merits, this case is largely-
Before you start, I have a question, and if you don't understand me, don't be shy to tell me. no one can understand me. Anyway, what did you hope to find with these requests for 911 calls?
I believe the question was, what did our client hope to find in making the request?
Yeah.
I don't think the record actually says one way or the other. I don't know the answer to that. That would be relevant potentially if we got so far down the path that we were doing a balancing under exemption 7.1c under the generalized privacy exemption, where there is a balance between the public interest in disclosure and the privacy issue.
What do citizen calls to the police have to do with transparency in government?
I apologize, Justice Schmidt. I was not able to understand.
Oh, don't apologize. It's me. What do 911 tapes have to do with transparency of government?
So I believe the question was, what do 911 calls have to do with transparency? To directly answer the question, knowing what information has been reported to law enforcement allows the public to understand, you know, better what the government does and doesn't do with that information. If they got a 911 call about something and didn't do anything about it, well, that would tell you something about government conduct. Or if they reacted in a certain way or a different way, having the context for that, would all show government conduct. It's a system that's paid for with tax dollars. And at the end of the day, there has never been an argument that these are not public records under FOIA. So under the definition of public record, if it pertains to public business, then it's a public record with some other caveats that don't really apply here. So that has never been a position that the sheriff's office has taken. They have never said.
Don't you think that if it would have a chilling effect on people reporting crimes if they knew that someone would just send a letter and get a copy of their call to the police?
I believe the question was about the chilling effect that could occur if this kind of information was released. If it was the case that a caller could be identified, then the statute does provide a mechanism for that information to be withheld under an exemption, which I'm sure is rooted in that very concept. But as the circuit court properly found, once the voice has been disguised, that concern goes away. You would not be able to identify a caller from a scrambled or masked or altered voice. And the circuit court reviewed the tapes in camera, looked at the affidavits, and concluded that the sheriff's office failed to prove by clear and convincing evidence that anyone could be identified either by the content or if the voice was altered. So the law does provide for that. We absolutely agree.
I might be able to identify someone by the content of their complaint, even though Judge Anderson couldn't.
Right. And I agree that it is possible that a subset of the entire community, maybe even a few people, might be enough to trigger the concerns about identifying someone who reports information to law enforcement. That is theoretically true. This is an issue of the standard of proof and the evidence required in a FOIA case. It is a clear and convincing evidence standard. It must be supported by detailed factual affidavits that address the record specifically and in detail, so there can be an adversary testing of that. And as the circuit court properly found, the affidavits that were offered here were very generic. They didn't deal with any of the specifics, and they're the kind of thing that could be said about any 911 call. If it is the case that the General Assembly believes that there is such a risk from any 911 calls being released, that people could be identified, then they, of course, are free to pass an exemption that would do that. But they haven't. This is an exemption that requires the government to prove by clear and convincing evidence that someone could be disclosed. And the circuit court properly found that there just wasn't evidence to support that. So this is really, by affirming here, you are not holding that in all instances 911 calls will have to be released. You're not holding that in all instances there will have to be the use of masking software. And I know to the questions about the burden and the expense involved, that the circuit court invited the sheriff's office to bring a motion in response to the order if it was going to claim that it wasn't feasible or that it was unduly burdensome, which is Section 3G of FOIA. We have a provision that provides exactly for that. And the sheriff's office did not take advantage of that. They did not file a motion. They didn't offer anything that would meet their burden under Section 3G. And so yes.
Let me ask you, is it clear to me that your client is seeking information about the person who called 911 and not the sheriff?
I think the question was it fair to, is it fair to the person who makes the call to have the information released? Is that correct?
No.
Sorry.
The whole point of the request was to seek information about a citizen, not the sheriff.
So the purpose of the request under longstanding FOIA law is typically not relevant to whether a record can be withheld or not. It can apply if we were dealing with an exemption that had a balancing against the public interest, but even there, the public interest is not about the requester's specific purpose so much as the general public interest in having information released. So unless the record will actually identify someone, then those exemptions, the privacy exemptions, simply cannot apply. We never have to get to the point of balancing the public interest versus the privacy interest because there is no invasion of privacy in the first instance if the record is produced in a way that does not allow that person to be identified. So I certainly understand that there's concern about personal privacy. The statute amply provides for that. There were mechanisms available to the sheriff's office, to try to withhold the records on that basis, but it still required the sheriff's office to prove that it would be identifiable. Otherwise, what you would have is simply a rule that says 911 recordings are exempt under FOIA, because you would always have that issue, and that is not the regime that the General Assembly has set up. This is a case-by-case analysis as to whether it actually would identify anyone.
How, Mr. Topic, is this order not a direction to create a different record from what exists in the sheriff's office?
I think that is most easily answered through the Bowie case, in which the Supreme Court said that the following things did not constitute creating a new record. Number one was removing data. I think we're all on the same page on that, and that actually redacting, removing portions, I don't think the sheriff's office even disputes. But Bowie also addressed masking the data, which meant the data was reordered. It had been in alphabetical order by class, and it was ordered to be reordered so that you couldn't figure out the students based on where they were in the list by comparing it to a class list. And if reordering information within a document is not the creation of a new record, then there's no basis to say that altering the audio, I mean, that's even less of, that's even further away from creating a new record, because the content has not been changed one bit. The only thing that's been changed is sort of the format.
But creating a writing from an audio is a creation of a new record, isn't it?
So I think that the question is a little bit different if you get to the alternative grounds that the circuit court based its decision on, which is creating a transcript. If you agree that altering the voice is not creation of a new record and you affirm, you do not need to address the question about whether creating a transcript would be a new record. On the one hand, yes, I certainly understand the intuitive appeal of you're actually now sort of creating something and that someone has to do that. Now, I think that can be done by software to some extent, but the question becomes under Section 6A, one of feasibility. It started as an electronic audio file. It would end up as an electronic written file. And that provision of the statute then has a feasibility analysis. And that is another area, again, where the circuit court invited the sheriff's office to file a motion if they felt it wasn't feasible to do that. And they did not file that motion. And so that would really be a question of case-by-case individual burden. The arguments about it requiring interpretation, I'm not sure I really follow those, because court reporters do this, as we all know, on day in and day out, court reporters transcribe what was said. So there are ways to do that. But I think the cleanest way to resolve this appeal is to affirm based on the audio issue alone, because if you do that, there's no need to address the question as to whether creating the transcript is a new record. Just a couple other points then I'll address. I think it's been talked about a little bit, but the Bowie decision is just buttressed by the purpose of FOIA and by the doctrine of liberal construction in favor of disclosure. The statute talks about that. It talks about the fundamental obligation of government to produce records, notwithstanding the fiscal obligations that sometimes might come along with that. In addition to Bowie, it's also supported by the purpose of this statute. We also cited to a New York State appellate court case, which ordered the altering of student voices in a student record. I think it's essentially the same issue. So there is precedent specifically for altering audio. I haven't seen any Illinois cases. The fact that there aren't really a lot of cases on this really suggests to me that that's because this doesn't normally happen. I mean, we know from watching the news that 911 calls are very often released to the public, sometimes even without any alterations. And so it's not surprising to me that there hasn't been occasion to address the specific issue, but I think it is very well analogous to the Bowie decision. Just quickly look if there was anything else. I think that covers everything. So I thank you very much for your time, unless there's any further questions.
Are there any additional questions?
No.
No? Thank you, Mr. Toppett. Mr. Myers, any rebuttal?
Thank you, Justice, and I'll keep it brief. Certainly, I appreciate Mr. Toppett raising the jurisdictional issue, and I think he did a good job addressing that. So I won't belabor the point. I think the first thing, Mr. Topic referenced the Bowie decision quite a bit. And I think Bowie is distinguishable from our current situation. It dealt with what I believe to be paper or certainly simple database records rather than a audio recording of an individual's voice. It's certainly one thing to move, say, student one, student in position one, because their name starts with A, to position 32 so that they can't be easily identified. It's a lot different to say, we want you as a governmental body to change the tone of their voice as well as the cadence so as to make them less identifiable. I think the question, the line of questioning by Justice Smith is also very interesting about the chilling effect. I think what you're looking at here is if there is a situation where we're trying to figure out what the government is doing with regard to information being brought to it. There are all sorts of ways that can be brought out. The caller can say, I felt like I was not handled properly, and I'd like to see that FOIA. I'd like to FOIA the audio, and they could provide that however they see fit. What is concerning, I think, from the sheriff's office is that the sheriff's office is a vast repository of information about private citizens. We're forced, for better or worse, to interact with government on sometimes a daily basis or a weekly basis. And me calling in to say, hey, my neighbor's having a loud party, or I feel like I'm having a heart attack, is a little bit different than trying to say, I'd like to know what the government, or I'd like to know what each taxpayer is paying on their property tax. What we're bringing here is often very personal information that doesn't necessarily bear any governmental function in the same way that other data might. I think the underlying thing here is what governmental transparency is advanced by allowing everybody's 911 call to be scooped up and perused sort of at will with a proper FOIA request. I could certainly see what every one of my neighbors is up to if I just sent a weekly request to the sheriff's office asking for all 911 calls in my block. That strikes me as possibly a bridge too far with FOIA. And finally, just to put a point on the issue of the creation of a record, as I've said before, what we're asking is not to just simply reproduce static information in a usable format. You know, if your computer is a Mac, certainly the government has an obligation to convert that to a Word if you are into that Mac file if it's not usable to you. What we're doing here is something additional. It is not just the change of a format or even changing of a medium. It is adding information, and I think in my brief I said in relation to the blurring of faces. The blurring of faces is one thing, but what's being asked to create a transcript or to create a new voice is to give that person a new face. And I think that is significantly different than what is required under FOIA. And with that, I'll rest, and I appreciate your time.
Are there any final questions for Mr. Myers?
No.
Thank you.
Thank you, Justices.
We thank both of you for your arguments this morning. We'll take the matter under advisement and we'll issue a written decision as quickly as possible. The court will now stand in recess, brief recess until 1 o'clock.